Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books and Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking about culture and economy in the age of social media with Christine Fuchs, who is a professor of social media research at the University of Westminster in London. So welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Dave. Thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
To kick off, it'd be really interesting to know a little bit about your intellectual and academic background and the sort of process that went into or was behind you writing this book.
Yes, so I'm a kind of a hybrid researcher. I have a background in computer science, but also in the social sciences, and I try to bring this together somehow. Yeah, so I'm interested in how the computer, the internet, and so on shape society, and is shaped by it. This has been my long-term interest. And how specifically this book came about is when I was working on two other books. Yeah, one is like a popular introduction to social media called Social Media Critical Introduction, and the other one covers labor in the digital age and was called Digital Labor and Karl Marx. And I worked on these books. It sort of resulted in a kind of intellectual debate, really, yeah, about how to conceptualize political economy of social media, and especially how it relates to labor and issues that relate to class. And so I found out there are a lot of issues that I should also deal with. And I sort of went deeper and deeper into theorizing these issues. And the outcome was this book then, yeah, Culture and Economy in the Age of Social Media.
So what's the main argument that the book is seeking to make?
Yes, so basically it's about very fundamentally about the relationship of culture and economy and how we should think about this relationship of culture and economy. So you could say it re-engages with the old question of how base and superstructure are related to each other, probably one of the most fundamental and most important question in Marxist theory, in critical theory in general. And then it relates it to the whole realm of digital media and social media. But why I think this is important is because my observation is that there's a tendency today in the contemporary cultural economy, you could say, where the boundaries between categories that we traditionally have thought of being separate are blurring. Yeah? Categories like culture and economy, labor and leisure, work and play, production and consumption, the private and the public, the home and the office, labor time and leisure time, and so on. So it's a kind of tendency, you could say, that it also has to do with the rise, partly, of what we could now call an information economy and information work, or cultural creative industries, call it. So the question that I think we need to ask then is that if it's no longer possible to separate these categories, or in broad terms, it's no longer possible to separate culture and economy, then maybe they have never been separate in the first instance. Yeah? And that's the kind of idea that is basically underlying the whole book. In the first chapter, set this more out in very general terms. And then my specific interest is social media. So in the second part of the book, you could say these are case studies of how to apply well, the approach of cultural materialism, you could say, to the whole realm of social media. One motivation also for writing this book is somehow that, I mean, on the one hand, I'm a media communication and cultural scholar, digital media scholar. On the other hand, I consider myself to be a Marxist scholar, yeah? But when I go to conferences in Marxist theory, yeah, then I do not like that culture and communication are not taken seriously. Then you have all these interesting talks about how to conceptualize the contemporary crisis, how to think about the tendency of the profit rate to fall, which is how to think about financialization. And then you have one talk that considers culture and communication somehow. So somehow it's culture and communication is in this community, like historical materialism conference, for example, still considered as a kind of superstructure. Yeah? At the same time, in our field of media, communication, cultural studies, I think that if you think of not just Marx himself, but the whole history of 20th century Western Marxism and how it has engaged with culture, I feel it's there is too much fear of scholars engaging with this history. I mean, basically with the argument that there is these approaches are reductionist, yeah? Reduce culture to the economy and so on. So I think there are also problems in engaging with this rich history of Marxist cultural and communication theory within our field. Yeah, and well, I think then you could say that whom this book addresses is on the one hand media and cultural scholars, and it's on the other hand critical theory scholars, yeah, who don't tend to think so much about cultural issues and communication issues, and it wants to engage with the question: why does cultural materialism matter today, and how should we think about it?
And the way you both address those audiences, engage with that question, but also, I think, seek to kind of move the theoretical debates on is to go back to Raymond Williams, who's a very important influence in the book. And I wonder if you could say a bit about why Williams matters and how you've employed some of his ideas.
Yes, so exactly. So Raymond Williams is very important for this book, probably the thinker who is most important theoretically in the theoretical foundations for the books. And just accidentally this Saturday, I was in Manchester at a conference called Raymond Williams Now, and it was very reassuring and really nice to see that there was a huge turnout, a lot of colleagues interested in Raymond Williams' works, very critical scholars applying Williams and his thinking to contemporary issues that concern culture and society. So I think that's very good. It shows us that Williams' thought is very important today. On the other hand, I think Williams is too much treated as a humanities scholar still there. Of course, I mean, he wrote very interesting novels himself in literature, like The Volunteers, Loyalties, and many other great books that I really think are fantastic. And he made a very huge contribution to literary studies. But my observation also at the Raymond Williams Now conference is that this is still the predominant discourse, yeah, to, and it's necessary, yeah. But I think there's more in Williams than just literature. Yeah? So the way I understand Williams is also as a cultural sociologist, really. And I think that's my interest in Williams and the approach of cultural materialism. And, you know, like also making the same, Jim McQuiggan has made the same observation. And that's why Jim has published recently a collection of essays called Raymond Williams on Culture and Society. So that's more Raymond Williams, the cultural sociologist. And also what Jim has engaged in a new edition of Williams' 1983 book Towards 2000, where he himself added like a new chapter, so thanks to Jim that he did this. I'm interested in Raymond Williams' approach of cultural materialism and how we can make use of it, because I think it helps us these dualisms that I was talking about, but especially the dualisms between work and communication and labor and ideology. I think it helps us to deconstruct these dualisms, because, for example, one observation that I'm making that people who study ideology, especially if you think of critical discourse analysis, yeah, they analyze really how ideology works. Yeah, that's a very excellent approach, but they don't ask the question, who are those who produce ideologies, yeah, the cultural or ideological workers who produce them, or those who are critics, maybe, who can challenge them. Yeah. So if you look, I looked into one of the books by Norman Fairclough, yeah, just like 500 pages about ideology, and searched for labor. And it's mentioned two times, only when he analyzes the ideology of new labor. Yeah. So that's kind of blind spot there. Yeah. On the other hand, if you look at people who study working conditions, especially in labor study, yeah, labor process studies and so on, then ideology tends more to be a blind spot there. So what I think is then really interesting is to ask, on the one hand, there is the ideology of labor on the one hand nowadays. Just think of the Tories when you repeat on and on and on saying we have to get people into work, yeah, and getting them into work. Not asking the question what quality does work have, especially for young people, yeah, and that given the fact that there's a lot of precarious labor and so on. And I looked at some statistics recently that it's true that in Britain a lot of jobs were created in the past couple of years, but the absolute majority of them are absolute bullshit jobs, yeah, precarious jobs, yeah, people on 0 hours contracts, low wages, and so on. So that's the ideology of labor, and then on the other hand, there's the labor of ideologies. And I think cultural materialism is a very good approach in order to understand how these categories that make up the cultural economy are related, and that we should think them together.
One of the ways of thinking these things together, I think, comes in the third chapter, where you try and discuss the idea of communication as a type of work, yes, as a form of work. And how is this the case, and why is this the case?
Yes. So how can we think of, and can we think of culture and communication and the production of it as forms of work? So I think basically there are two approaches of how to think about cultural or information work. I personally prefer the term information work, because it's a less value-laden term than creative work or cultural work, because the problem that you have, for example, with the term creative work or creative industries is that there's always an outside to it. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So typically then you make a distinction between those who are creative and those who are not creative. Yeah? And the issue is then also that you could, that how I think about creativity is much more is a fundamental anthropological feature of human activity as such. So whenever we produce something, we create some forms of use values that satisfy human needs. So I would say all human activity, in a sense, is also creative. Yeah? But of course, how the term creative cultural industries has come to be understood is that it involves all those work that create some kind of content that is symbolic and that is meaningful. However, the question now is, in order for culture, information, or also digital content and so on to exist, what forms of work do we need on the one hand? Yeah, and of course, information work is hugely expanding since many decades now. But there's also the whole physical infrastructure that enables this content, because in an information society and economy, content tends to be mediated. Yeah, so there are also means of production, circulation, and consumption technologies, yeah, cultural technologies, digital technologies that are produced and used. And the argument that I want to make is that these workers, yeah, who produce technologies should also be included in the definition of information work. So basically, there, you could either say that information work is only seen as those who produce informational and symbolic content, or you could say it's the collective worker of all those workers who contribute with their labor to the existence of information as content and information technologies that help to produce, circulate, and consume informational content. And I think we should not think of these theoretical questions as abstract questions. This would be cultural idealism, really. The reason why to argue for such a broad understanding is really more a political issue, because in the end, I think it's all about the political question: in what kind of economy do we want to live? Yeah, what's the quality of work? And definitely, from a progressive political perspective, we want to improve the quality of work. Yeah, for all people. Yeah, within what is in a narrow sense called the cultural industries. And outside of it, yeah. And now I think the advantage of the broad understanding is that it can see that there is really a global division of labor that has emerged in the digital and information industries. So it's really difficult to separate different forms of work that are, well, producing content or that are industrial forms of manufacturing or even extractive forms of work, because in the end, they tend to work for the same kind of multinational companies. And of course, I mean, what is specific also for culture is because of its specific properties and economic qualities, it is a good that when treated as a commodity and as an economic good, it tends to result quite easily in highly concentrated industries, so that you have a bunch of multinational companies controlling production in these companies. So in the end, if we want to improve the quality of work, I think we must avoid avoid methodological and political nationalism somehow, and see the global dimension of these industries really. And in the end, the question then is also if the information workers in the world can somehow unite and show some form of solidarity in order to improve these qualities of work. Because clearly, the problem is that politics is predominantly made within the nation state, or it's regional, whereas the economy is global. Yeah, so this contradiction between the global economy and politics that is in the nation state, the question is how to intervene there. And if you have a working class in a broad sense, or political movements that only struggle for improvements within the national framework, it might not work that well, because capital is really flexible and can globally outsource labor. And it's also a question for trade unions. Yeah, so because for trade union it's very difficult because they are very nationally oriented. Yeah, but if trade unions and labor also just like capital start to organize globally, then this can strengthen their power. And I think from this political perspective, this broad understanding of information work is a better approach. It somehow also comes back to this Raymond Williams approach of cultural materialism, because Williams says we should avoid cultural idealism, which would just mean that if you think of piano music and the way it's being produced and maybe even sold, that just the piano player, creative artist, is an information worker or is a cultural worker, whereas in a broad sense, it would then mean that also the piano maker and the composer of music are cultural and information workers, and that what we would hope for is a trade union, if they organize collectively, where they are all brought together. Yeah? And of course, there are also tendencies nowadays that there's a kind of labor union convergence, that different information workers in different industries organize together, which makes them also more powerful in the end.
The examples you use in the later parts of the book address that directly, and you develop this idea of the international division of digital labor, the IDDL. in chapter 6, and you give examples of this more kind of global political economy in chapter 7. And I wonder if you could, sketch out some more concrete examples of what you were talking about under the umbrella of where it is that information communication technologies come from, where it is that, our ability in the West, for example, to be on an iPhone using Facebook or Twitter, to surf the web and stuff, actually is dependent on a much broader chain of production.
Yes. So what I'm observing, like in political discussions, is like two extreme positions. Yeah. On the one hand, people who just focus on how to politically organize or unionize people in the West, yeah, who work in the cultural industries in a narrow sense, yeah, young people who are working precariously, and you can have ideas like that they should form cooperatives and so on, and to just focus on like the national or maybe European dimension of it. Yeah? And on the other hand, people who are interested in how labor in developing countries works, how outsourced labor is experienced in precarious forms of labor, and the question what can be done about it. Yeah, and, the approach of the, I mean, that goes back to the late 70s or early 1980s, really, of the international division of labor, sees that these forms of labor are interconnected, really. Yeah, so there are huge multinational companies developing who, in order to maximize their profits, are outsourcing labor and are playing out workers in different countries against each other, and of course, what we can generally see within the information economy, the digital media industries are very important, both in terms of employment and especially in terms of value added. So, I think the digital media industry really, most countries, when you look up the statistics, you can see digital media industries in terms of value added are very crucial for this industry, just like advertising, public relations, and so on. And of course, digitization affects all of our lives, and therefore the question is, what forms of labor are involved in the production of digital media technologies and digital content? And with Raymond Williams, we could say it's then very important to start like really at the very foundation, which is the question like, the laptop that is on the table here, yeah? Our mobile phones, where do they come from? Yeah? So first, there is extractive work. People who work in mining industries that extract minerals that then go into our digital tools. And it's this phenomenon of so-called conflict minerals in Africa, especially the Congo, where people work under slave-like conditions. So, I mean, you would think of that in modern capitalist society, we are all double free wage workers, but we are not. So there are around, if you look at statistics, around 30 million slaves in the world who are not double free in Marx's sense, but who are whose bodies and minds are the property of someone. So basically it means if they don't go into these mines, they are killed and being shot. So that's a very unsettling physical foundation of the digital media industries. Then, in the second step, if you have these minerals, out of the minerals, components are produced. The components are assembled into digital media technologies. Most of the assemblage work takes place in China. So China plays a very important role in the manufacturing industries within the international division of labor. And, I mean, China's economy is somehow also peculiar, yeah? Because on the one hand, there's a huge growth of the Chinese GDP, which is partly based on the fact that China invests a lot in the build-up of an urban infrastructure. On the other hand, Chinese economy is to a very large extent export-oriented, especially in two sectors, electronics and hardware on the one hand, and clothes on the other hand. And so a form of digital labor is also the workers in Foxconn and other large transnational companies where especially young urban migrants in industrial zones in China under very hard, really traditional Taylorist working conditions, you could say, assemble these technologies. So they have very long working hours, low wages, rather unregulated forms of work. They're only yellow unions, or they're rather ununionized, and so on. So these are industrial and extractive forms of labor. But then, of course, there are newer forms of jobs that create content, or also that create software. And here there are also two different forms. On the one hand, if you look at the software industry, to a certain extent, is also makes use of outsourcing, especially outsourcing on the one hand to Ireland, on the other hand to India. Yeah, so there is a new kind of middle class in India developing of software engineers. It's also a global dimension. But on every, and there is the work to the largest extent for Western companies. Yeah, so they are coding basically. And on average, statistics shows the average salaries are just 10% of the salary of a of a software engineer, maybe in the United States. Then that's one form of software engineering. Then you have other software engineers who, for example, work for Google, yeah, or for other large software companies. I think there, if you look at their working conditions, it's more the story that is quite characteristic for the cultural and creative industries at large. So these software engineers, they really like their job. They think it's a form of creativity. On the other hand, they work very long hours. Their social life suffers under it, and so on. Probably, if you compare people who work more in art and culture in the narrow sense, if you compare them to software engineers, the one difference is that in terms of income, people in the arts tend to be more struggling, yeah? Whereas software engineers tend to have very high salaries. Yeah, that's the one. But in terms of working patterns, working long hours, and so on, it's pretty much comparable. Yeah. And what is also interesting is the kind of culture, the workplace culture, developing in Google and other kind of companies, because here you can really see the convergence between labor and play, because if you look at the Googleplex, yeah, it's a kind of playground almost. Yeah, people can spend their leisure time there. There are sports grounds there. And if you've seen some of these images, yeah, partly it does not really look like an office. It looks really like a playground, which in the end also means people spend more time in the office. And so what Google and other companies hope for is also that people then work longer hours and that there's more job satisfaction, so that they also work more productively. And then there are also all forms of work that are really not possible without the internet, that are based on the internet. So I'm thinking, for example, of the online freelancing platforms that have become. I mean, we know that in the media, cultural, and digital industries, the largest share of freelancers is really working in these industries, the largest relative share. Yeah? And of course, how these freelancers nowadays tend to find work, yeah, is via online freelancing platforms. I mean, freelancing is much older than this, yeah, but there are specific forms of freelancing now developing that make use of these platforms. On average, you can see that the wages that are paid via these platforms tend to be lower via traditional professional organization. The problem again is one that the regulation of working conditions is via the nation state. Yeah, whereas the economy is global and also the internet is global. So if you think of Odesk and Elance, for example, yeah, it's a US company. They were two companies, but they were merged. But then the question: should there be a minimum wage for online freelancing? Where is it to be decided, really? Yeah? And you have a global workforce competing for jobs against each other. And I think there was a kind of voluntary move by Oland or Edesk to introduce a minimum wage of $3 per hour, which is really for British standards, that's very low, because our minimum wage now is it £6.75 or £8.5, yeah, something like this. So it creates a lot of problems then. And the idea of digital labor then tries to engage with all of these questions and also to see that these different forms of work are globally interconnected. I mean, they are very different on the one hand. On the other hand, they tend to produce value in a kind of interconnected labor network for the same kind of multinational companies.
The final area of this international vision of digital labor, which is something really that comes up slightly earlier in the book and then is played forward in a comparison between the US and China, is this kind of presumption or the, I suppose, the productiveness of the consumer.
Yeah.
Particularly Facebook is the obvious example, but you have examples from Chinese social media platforms as well. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk through ideas about particularly economic rents, discuss with reference to Marx, the idea of Facebook's business model being about or being engaged with the idea of rent.
Yes. So basically, it's a very complex debate about digital labor and how to theorize its economy, really, that has developed in the past couple of years. And I'm very deep in these discussions, really. Yeah, it can seem a bit esoteric sometimes to people who are not experts in Marx Capital Volume 1, 2, and 3. But basically, it's about the question how to use Marx concepts of rent and or productive labor in order to understand the political economy of digital labor. Yeah, and now rent is a concept that Marx especially uses in Capital Volume 3. Basically, rent means renting something, that money is paid for the use of a good for that you use for a limited time period. Yeah. So just think of the London property market. Yeah. A huge class of rentiers has developed that controls property in London and is renting it out for extremely high prices. This is helped by the deregulation of the housing market, its privatization, and also its financialization, and it creates huge social problems, as we know. So, in these terms, you could say rent is an important category still today. However, what is the important thing about this category of renting is that typically you rent out goods that do not continuously have to be produced and reproduced. Yeah. That's why Marx uses it, especially in terms of housing assets, and natural properties, and that's also how David Harvey has taken up this idea, because he's interested in questions of space and urban sociology and so on. The question is now, when we are dealing with information and culture and digital content, does here the idea of rent help us? And in my opinion, it does not help us, because if you compare it with houses, or these kind of assets, if you own a house, then first it must be built by the builders. You have some form of reconstruction from time to time going on, but in the end, it's not a very dynamic kind of good. It's a very fixed, immobile kind of good. If it's once there, it will give you a rent for a long time. You don't have to continue. You don't have to year by year rebuild the house in order to sell it. Yeah. Now, if you think of Facebook, Google, Twitter, and so on, some people are saying that's quite comparable to these kind of goods, and I think it's not comparable, because I think they are really very dynamic goods that depend on the continuous production of data and content by the users themselves. Yeah, this makes them very different. So if you just have Facebook and all information that is now there, and all users leave tomorrow, it's completely valueless, because what is really the interesting thing is the continuous use of these platforms and the continuous production. That's where also this idea of presumption comes in, that the consumers become producers, and that's also why they are, you could say, they are workers and digital workers in the sense of continuously producing attention, producing content, producing social relations, communicating there. And of course, the important thing is that Google and Facebook are not communications companies. They are the world's largest advertising companies. Yeah? So I'm specifically interested in the critique of the advertising and consumer culture that has developed nowadays, and that it really forms the context of contemporary social media. So that's why I'm more interested in the idea of productive labor that also Marx has elaborated. And it's also a complex category somehow, yeah, because he has three levels of how to define productive labor. Yeah, but really the interesting level here for me is just the third one, where Marx introduces in Capital Volume 1, Chapter 16, the idea of the collective worker, where he says, in modern economy, it tends to become ever more a networked economy, yeah? So that the value that is being produced and that is objectified in commodities is produced by a whole network of different forms of worker that contribute to the production of the value added that is objectified in this commodity. Yeah. So now, if what we can observe is that then there is an interconnection really of paid and unpaid labor that is produced, that is conducted in the sphere of production and in the sphere of circulation. There's also this tendency that consumers tend to become producers, which breaks down the boundary between economy and culture. And I think this is exactly this changing the landscape of culture and economy is exactly the context of what we are witnessing in the social media economy. Yeah, so there are, just think of the way we are using social media. We are using them at the workplace. Yeah, we are using them privately. We are using them politically in civil society. But all our activities and contacts converge on specific profiles. Yeah? So the boundaries between different forms of information activities, yeah, and between our different social roles are really collapsing. And therefore it's very difficult nowadays in some situations, yeah, to distinguish what is work time, what is leisure time, to distinguish between what is productive and unproductive labor. So the tendency is, unfortunately, nowadays that a lot of what we have traditionally in a Taylorist Fordist economy have thought of as our leisure time is becoming integrated in and becoming a productive labor time also in itself. Yeah. And so this is sometimes misunderstood. What I'm arguing against is an orthodox form of Marxism that has an outdated idea of what the working class is and conceives the working class as the industrial workers that were dominant 100 years ago, yeah, that were the paid industrial proletariat. And I'm arguing for a more kind of open Marxism that sees that the economy is on the one hand becoming more cultural, more digital, and that forms of unpaid work and forms of precarious work are really also very important in the way value is being created. So, I mean, the problem that still persists, but it's getting better for the trade unions, is still, should freelancers be considered to be part of the working class? Yeah, of course they should, but, I mean, when this debate started, then first trade unions were dismissing the freelancers and saying, well, they are capitalists and so on. Yeah, and I think that's the outdated version. On the other hand, I would include them in a broad category of the working class today. But then and these debates, I mean, since the 1970s about whom to consider as a productive worker, they have broadened out. If you think of Marxist and socialist feminism in the 1970s, who were really putting on the agenda the unpaid house workers and how important their work is really for society at large, but particularly also for the existence of capitalism, then this was a shift in how to conceptualize productive worker, to also include the house workers. And of course, then political demands were made by the feminists, like wages for housework and so on. And then there was also the kind of post-colonial debate starting that the developing countries, especially in this international division of labor, are also exploited colonies of capitalism that produce a lot of value that is then exported into the West. Yeah? And of course, the increase of foreign direct investment levels in developing countries is exactly this phenomenon. So you could, and then a third tendency was also to see that that the cultural economy and plays a more important role, that advertising plays a very important role in the capitalist organization of this cultural economy, and that we should therefore also consider, well, those consumers who produce the commodity in the advertising industries, the audience commodity, or now concerning Facebook and so on, it would be a kind of data commodity, that they are also workers in a sense. Yeah? But if you include all of this and more, yeah, the freelance workers and so on, then you arrive at a pretty broad understanding of how value is being produced today, and that all of these workers are also productive workers, which then brings up the question, if the political question again, if we want to have a progressive civil society that struggles for a better quality of work, better conditions of human existence in contemporary society, and if you want to have progressive political parties, and in the end also the question, what is the left today really? Yeah. That then the left must really renew itself, yeah, and I think it can do this also by reaching out to all these groups in society. At the same time, I think the left has not done this to a significant extent today. And that's why I think these very abstract debates, going back to questions of productive labor and so on, in the end can also help us to ask the question, how does a contemporary left-wing movement and a left-wing political party look like? How should it look like today? And I think that's especially important in the situation that we are now in the world, in Europe, but also in Britain, because now Thatcherism is turning into Cameronism. Yeah? And I think that will be the key political challenge in the next 5 years, will be how to challenge Cameronism, really. And I was recently going back to the writings, on the one hand, Raymond Williams, on the other hand, also Stuart Hall, of how to understand Thatcherism. Yeah? Because I think it really matters, because now the key political question, the key political struggle is really, what is Cameronism? How do we challenge it? And, of course, there were debates about Stuart Hall's concept and so on, yeah, by Bob Jessop and so on and others. But I think the key contribution that Stuart Hall and others, and also Raymond Williams and so on, was really to understand Thatcherism also as an ideological phenomenon of authoritarian populism so on. And also the understanding that the rise of Thatcherism had to do with the failure of the left, the weakness of the left. And I think that's exactly what is happening now, that really the rise of Cameronism, yeah, and its strength also has to do with the weakness of the left, yeah, the kind of orthodoxies of the left. It also has to do with the Labour Party and the fact that the Labour Party probably is also Thatcherite and too much. It has not offered a popular alternative vision, really. Yeah. So I think when Nicola Sturgeon was observing, what Ed Miliband had in mind was a form of Toryism light. Yeah? I think she was right, and it would be the key question is now, are these popular alternatives, can they be constructed by a renewed left, or will we end up with the whole political spectrum moving ever more towards the right, as was the tendency today, since a lot of decades, not offering a vision for an alternative, and ending up what Tariq Ali in his new book calls the extreme center, yeah? The extreme center in the sense of what was the left in former times has shifted now more towards the center and the center right, so that they all speak the same kind of language. So I think also nowadays, in the situation we are now in globally, in Europe also, because Europe and European identity is also in a crisis. And of course, the challenge to Europe is the right-wing challenge, or the Tories, you could say, because like Thatcher, they think Europe is too socialist in a sense. Yeah? At the same time, of course, it just means what Europe is actually is also a neoliberal project that is being challenged, but also in the European South by Greece and Spain and so on. So it's a challenge to what Europeanness and European identity really is. So that's at the European level, and at the national level in Britain, I think the challenge will really be, can there be alternatives to Cameronism? And for the left, I think these debates then, yeah, to whom do they speak, really? Yeah, what kind of politics do they do? Just like in the 80s when Stuart Hall was pointing this out, also play a role today.
So will you be working on that in future projects, or are you going to be doing something completely different?
Mm. So I continue to do a lot of work on everything that relates to social media, digital labor, and so on. But probably I'm working also on three other projects now. Yeah, one is it has to do with Marx Capital, because there are all these Marx works are now seen since the crisis started really in 2008 is by a lot of people by being interesting today. Yeah, but I think we should avoid a kind of orthodoxy. The political solutions for all the difficult political questions that we have today is not written down in Marx still, yeah? But there are some, it can be a kind of, reading Marx can allow us to ask questions that he was asking in a contemporary context. However, all the kind of, Marx is very difficult to read, yeah? So you need a kind of complementary literature to it. But all these books, like I'm thinking, for example, of David Harvey's Companions to Marx Capital, they completely ignore questions of technology, the digital, culture, communication. So I thought such a book has to be written that helps us in a non-orthodox, open Marxist manner to engage with Marx and how it relates to, well, the cultural economy, the information society, and so on. So one of what I did recently is to work on a book called Marx in the Information Age. The subtitle is Reading Marx Capital Volume 1, from a media and communication studies perspective. So that will be coming out next year. Yeah, that's one of my interests. A second interest is that I was interested in how to use specific philosophers that we are normally not using in media and cultural theory. How can we make use of their approaches? Yeah? So newer forms of critical theory. So I was interested in Slavoj Žižek's work on the dialectic and Hegel, and have engaged with this. I was interested in newer debates about Heidegger, because there's, if you think of philosophy today and also of media and cultural theory, there's a lot of use of Heidegger actually. And at the same time, that these black notebooks were published by Heidegger that showed that what awful anti-Semitic ideology he really had. This has resulted in a lot of new debates about can we make use of Heidegger, really? And I think it's important to engage with these questions. So I've been working on this. And then I have been working on also on the question, how we can we make use of Georg Lukács' approach. But whenever you talk about Lukács, then people talk about history and class consciousness. Yeah, and I think that's a good book, but actually there's an overlooked book by Lukács called The Ontology of Social Being. It was his last book before he died, really. And it was published like in German in two volumes, 1,500 pages. Only like 200 pages have been translated into English. Yeah, and this is really a very fine social theory, you could say, where he also engages with questions of culture and ideology in a new, refreshing sense. And I was interested in how can we take up this today. And then I've engaged also with Axel Honneth's work, because Honneth, well, I think internationally he's a little bit overlooked still, but you could say he's the new Habermas in German critical theory. And all these debates about, he works on the theory of recognition, and also on the one hand, he has been in this debate with Nancy Fraser about redistribution and recognition. And he also has taken up Lukács' idea of reification, yeah? And I'm thinking of how to apply this to media and culture. So these are philosophical debates. That's my second contemporary interest. And now my big newest interest is just coming out of political necessity, as I was just mentioning. I think in Britain it's necessary in order to ask the question, what is Cameronism? Yeah? What is it all about? What does it mean for contemporary society? How does its discourse really work, yeah, and what can be done against it, yeah. So I think just from a social and cultural theory perspective, I think it can be worthwhile that we go back to the discussions in the 80s, yeah, about what is saturism really, because Stuart Hall, yeah, Raymond Williams, Bob Jessop, and others, they were exactly asking this question in the 80s when saturism was becoming such a huge phenomenon. Yeah. Now, after these elections, now in May, it's clear that Cameronism is not just a temporary project. It's most likely it will be at least a 10-year project. Yeah, and of course, it's grounded in saturism. Yeah, David Cameron himself says that Margaret Thatcher had a huge impact on his thinking. So we should trace out what are the continuities and discontinuities between Cameronism and Thatcherism. I think the idea of authoritarian populism can help us in this respect. Also, the engagement with Cameronism as a form of ideology is quite important because, it is interesting if you look at the demographics of these elections, and I think that I looked at it, Ipsos Mori statistics for it. Yeah, and of course the middle and upper class tend to vote for the Tories. Yeah, but what is really interesting is this demographic group C2, as it's called, yeah, which are the classical blue collar workers, really. Yeah, and I think that's really a contested group because they equally voted for Labour and for the Tories, I think something like 31% each. 19% in this group voted for the UK Independence Party, which is, so they are also the largest social group voting for UKIP. And then on the other hand, the voter turnout in this group is extremely low. It's 51%, which also means 50% of the people in this group are completely disillusioned and saying, I'm not represented by anyone. But it's then interesting that more than 50% of those that voted for right-wing parties, the UKIP and the Conservatives. So the left must then also ask itself, what are the failures that we cannot convince these people, yeah, and others, yeah, and how can we win them back on the one hand, and what kind of counter narrative can we develop? So that's something I'm interested in now, and I try to connect this to my interest in social media because I'm especially interested in how the ongoing debates or the debates that you will see in the next 2 years. And I think it's really a question about identity and immigration, about the question, what is British identity, what is Englishness today, what is European identity, what is global identity, the question of migrant workers, yeah, and what kind of role they have in contemporary Britain. How these struggles about identity and recognition and its economic dimensions, because if it's about migration, it's always also an economic issue having to do with jobs, housing, public services, how they are expressed in public discourse, but now in politics also when these discourses are expressed, then social media also plays a role, yeah? And how discourses are analyzed on social media predominantly is now via big data analysis, yeah, which is a huge thing, yeah, big data analysis in a quantitative sense, yeah, that people do sentiment analysis, mm-hmm, predictions of elections, and so on. And I think there's actually something going wrong because it's completely quantitative. These are large-scale computing methods, yeah. I think it does not... some of these results are quite interesting, but they always remain quantitative. Sometimes they are trivial. There's an election debate on the BBC between the main candidates. People analyze about what do people tweet, and then their result is that while the candidates were discussing immigration, people were tweeting about immigration. Yeah, and that's not very meaningful, I think. But the question is then, for example, how do these discourses about identity, immigration, and so on, how are they expressed in 140 characters on Twitter? Yeah, how do MPs tweet about these things? Yeah, because Twitter, even more than Facebook, has become a kind of news medium in itself. Journalists, when they look for what is happening in the political world, they go on Twitter. Yeah, a lot of people get for a lot of people, it has become the primary source of political information. Yeah? So I'm interested in how social media then is expressed there. But from a methodological point of view, I think we need to further develop critical discourse analysis as an approach, because critical discourse analysis, as some people who come from this field say, somehow has missed the whole emergence of the internet. So they still tend to predominantly analyze, when it comes to the media, discourses on television and in newspapers, which have a huge influence. But somehow, for example, the television discourses are now mediated with the discourses on social media. Because while these electoral debates and so on are going on, people are tweeting about it and so on. So it can be quite an interesting idea to look at the discourses, the way ideology works on social media, and also how it's contested there. And for this, I think we need more. We need definitely social media as a data source, and collecting all of this data is a challenge in itself. But then I think we need new qualitative approaches for how to analyze this data. So it's also a methodological challenge, really. So on the one hand, it's a kind of project for analyzing what is politically happening. On the other hand, it's also a further development of social science methods that is too much focused on quantitative analysis at the moment, and where the qualitative dimension is really missing. So I think that's kind of approach of critical qualitative analysis of data that comes out of social media and that is situated in the analysis of the political challenges that lie ahead in Britain, Europe, and the world today.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory, when we were talking about culture and economy in the age of social media, by Christine Fuchs, published by Routledge.